Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. The time is 1:31 p.m. Before we begin, we want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Dylan Williams from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, Senator Kaufman, Senator Tobin, my Vice Chair, Senator Keel, myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is Senate Bill 60, Repeal Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, sponsored by Senator Wilkowski. Our office requested a committee substitute that we received right before we began this meeting. After the meeting, our office will distribute the proposed committee substitute to members' offices, and we intend to have further discussions about the CS once we have had more time to review. That next hearing would likely be on Wednesday. Wednesday next week. Today, our intention is to open public testimony. Before opening public testimony, I want to invite the bill sponsor. If they want to make any comments, to please come forward, but it's up to you. Nope, okay. So with that, we're going to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill 60? If so, please come forward. Mr. Hemingway, welcome. If you want to identify yourself for the record, you can proceed with your comments, and I would note that we limit public testimony to 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Andy Hemingway. I retired as chair of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission in 2016, and I'm appearing today in my personal capacity in opposition to Senate Bill 60. I'd like to address 2 points. First is the fact that the commission's ruling have the force of legal precedent. And second is the commission's caseload. First, I want to stress the importance of the fact that the commission's decisions have the force of legal precedent. Before the commission was created, appeals from the board went to the superior court. Decisions by the superior court do not have the force of legal precedent. This means that when the superior court ruled on a legal question involving the workers' compensation statutes, neither the board nor insurance companies would need to abide by the ruling in future. So if the board disagreed with the ruling, it could keep doing things the way it wanted. Likewise, if an insurance company or an attorney representing injured workers disagreed with the ruling, they could keep doing what they wanted and disregard the Superior Court's ruling in future cases. Moreover, there was nothing to prevent another Superior Court judge from ruling differently in a later case. This created uncertainty regarding what rules would be applied. To end that uncertainty, when the legislature created the commission, it included in statute a directive that the decisions of the commission have the force of legal precedent. This means that the board, insurance companies, workers, and their attorneys know what the rules are and can plan and act accordingly. Of course, if the parties to a case don't like the commission's ruling, they can appeal to the Supreme Court. Because the commission's decisions create binding precedents, it's especially important that these decisions are the product of a body with experience and expertise in workers' compensation law. Legal expertise on the part of the chair and practical experience on the part of the lay members of the commission, who by statute must have served on the workers' compensation board. With respect to caseload, the number of cases has dropped drastically in the last 3 years. But the reason for this is simply that the number of claims filed with the board similarly dropped, and that inevitably leads to lower cases before the board and eventually lower appeals to the commission. I suspect that this is related in some fashion to the COVID epidemic, which coincided with the drop in claims, but of course there's no way of knowing.
Mr. Hemingway, you're about the 2 minute mark. If you would conclude your remarks,
that just with great. That, I would expect that you'll see the levels go back up. They're already at 6 appeals this year, which is equivalent pace to 24, which would be their normal caseload they've had in the past. So, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Any questions?
I don't see any questions, but thank you very much. Okay. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to provide testimony on Senate Bill 60? Seeing no one else, I do have one online, Michael Budzinski. Mr. Budzinski, if you're on a phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear and it's often difficult to hear what you're saying. If you want to identify yourself for the record and then proceed, again, we'll try to keep our comments to 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Michael Budzinski here. I'm an attorney in Anchorage. I practice in the area of workers' compensation and have done so for over 40 years. So I practiced both when appeals went to the Superior Court and then when they went to the Commission beginning in 2005. And the current, in my view, the current situation involving the Appeals Commission and the structure is far superior to the prior procedure going to the Superior Court, in part because the commission members are very knowledgeable about workers' compensation. There's experience requirements for the members of the commission, and when you argue before them, you can tell, you know, that they understand what you're saying. We use acronyms, shorthand for and legal slang for a lot of the things that we discuss with the commission, because we know that they know what we're talking about. That's a huge advantage in any appeal. Also, the precedential value, as Mr. Hemingway commented, is very real. And there's a third thing that I've experienced recently with the commission, and that is they've had the courage in one of the cases I'm involved with in actually giving pushback to the Supreme Court on legal issues. And I think that's valuable for the commission to have that ability to give that pushback, because you get a better result legally when there's that give and take among these different bodies. But I think maintaining the commission is the wisest thing to do. The change was needed in 2005, and the reasons behind it remain today. Thank you.
I have one question. If you've been involved in workers' comp, are you working primarily on the employer side or the employee side of the workers' comp proceedings?
The employer side, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I confess myself intrigued. Pushing back on the Supreme Court on legal matters is seldom the way it works structurally. Can you enlighten me a little bit about what sort of pushback a commission like this gives to the Alaska Supreme Court on legal questions?
I can. The issue before the court, and actually still is before the court, is the issue of attorney's fees and rates of attorney's fees to be paid to attorneys who represent injured workers. There has been a claim or an attempt to increase those rates very substantially into the range of $600 to $900 per hour from the range of $400 to $450, which was much more common. And the commission made its award, as it normally did, at $450 per hour for an appeal that was appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, we think a much higher rate is appropriate. They sent it back to the commission to reconsider, and the commission said, no, we're not going to reconsider. We think we got it right. And now that is back to the Supreme Court. And so, you know, that to me presents a certain amount of legal courage, and is a very valuable thing, because the issue is very real for employers to be overpaying attorney's fees to injured workers' attorneys.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the added insight. I may need to learn more about this. It sounds to me as though the avenue for employers would be to come to the legislature if there is a different standard than the standard in the law as interpreted by the Supreme Court. I'm troubled.
Yeah, that may happen. They may have to go to the legislature for some relief, because it is completely a statutory system, and so the legislature gets to decide these things.
I will note, unrelated, but I do find it interesting in other matters before the legislature that the executive branch seems to be comfortable paying outside attorneys $600 to $900 an hour to represent us on some of their statehood defense claims. And so where there was a day in which I was troubled to hear those kinds of higher rates, it seems to have become normal in many respects here in the Capitol.
The rate was actually awarded by the Supreme Court. And not at the board level. And then the issue became, should the commission also adopt that rate? The commission said, no, we don't want to.
Is the opinion talking about a published Supreme Court decision?
Yes, but it's still on appeal again, so it's still ongoing.
Is the first case published that they remanded back to the commission?
Yes, the case is, the first name of the injured worker is Rush, R-U-S-C-H. And there are two injured workers involved, but that's the first name, and the employer was Southeast Alaska Regional Health Corporation, or SEARCH for short.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
I don't have anyone else online to testify, and no one else in the room, so I'm going to close public testimony. We will hold Senate Bill 60 and likely have it back on our schedule next week. Our next order of business today is House Joint Resolution 3, Concealed Handgun Reciprocity Between States, sponsored by Representative Rauscher. This is the first hearing of the resolution in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Representative Rauscher and his staff, Ryan McKee. If you would both please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you may begin your remarks. Actually, I'll note as they're coming and getting seated, we also have Lieutenant Robert French from the State Troopers and Lisa Purinton from the Department of Public Safety and Division Director managing the Alaska Concealed Handgun Permit Program who will be available to answer questions should you have any. Representative Rauscher, welcome.
For the record, my name is George Rauscher, District 29. I'd like to thank the committee, and I'd like to thank Chairman Clayman for hearing this bill. I appreciate it very much. House Joint Resolution 3 would encourage Congress to amend the Federal Criminal Code to allow an individual who is qualified to carry or possesses a concealed handgun in one state to be allowed to also carry or possess a concealed handgun in another state that also allows individuals to carry concealed firearms. This resolution would also request that Congress would enact the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, H.R. 38, from the 117th Congress, or a similar bill which does the same. The NRA, of American Institute for Legislative Action, has provided multiple reasons for supporting national reciprocity, and I'll give you some of the examples. In 2008, the Supreme Court affirmed that Alaskans have a constitutionally protected individual right to keep and bear arms. Furthermore, no state can deny a constitutional right. Concealed carry permit holders are among the most law-abiding citizens in the country. In 2014, a study out of 875,000 Floridian permit holders, the rate of concealed carriers who had their permits revoked was 0.0007%. And in Texas, a state with 584,850 permit holders, a rate of 0.21% were revocated of a misdemeanor or a felony. Reciprocity laws can change frequently with little or no notice. With little public notice, otherwise law-abiding citizens are at a much greater risk of becoming accidental criminals. Other citizens are often just unaware that they cannot drive through certain states with concealed weapons. One such person is Brian Fisher. Also, he traveled through North Carolina and New Jersey for disaster relief work, volunteered information about his legally owned firearm to the police officer in New Jersey, and was arrested for subsequently facing 5 years in prison. For other detailed reasons, some other information on why members should support HJR 3, I would like to turn it over to my staffer, Ryan McKee, and he can give you some other information. Thank you.
Mr. McKee.
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative Rauscher. So we do have a couple people on line or in the room for questions, and so at this point we'd like to just address any questions the committee may have.
Questions for Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to start by saying that I deeply respect you and your work. However, I am very upset with this, particularly because I'm married to a federal law officer, and I'm reading through some of the current research that showcases in states that have dropped their conceal and carry permits that they've had a significant increase in officer-involved shootings. And I want my husband to come home to me every night. I deeply want that. And so I'm curious to know from your perspective, and if you've talked to law officers, if you've talked to our fraternities of peace officers, what their interpretation of this is, if they support this bill, if they have input, if they have reached out to you, if you've reached out to them.
Uh, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Senator Tobin. We do have a member of the troopers online. I don't believe they've taken a stance on this, but if you'd like to direct your question to them, I'm sure he can give you a response.
So we've got Lieutenant Robert French from the state troopers, as well as Lisa Purinton, who's in the room.
And just for clarity, Mr. Chair, I'd like to know if they're representing their organization or if they're speaking for themselves.
Oh, wait, let me see where he is. I'm on the wrong tab. Oh, wait. Hold on.
Senator Rauscher through the chair to Senator Tobin.
Hold on. Mr. French is online. And it looks like he's here on behalf of the troopers. Mr. French, or Lieutenant French, can you hear us?
Yes, sir, I can hear you.
Did you hear Senator Tobin's question?
Yes, I did. To the senator, I am not here to make a blanket policy statement on that. I was just simply here to answer any questions or take any notes for any further questions.
So the question is, do you have any information about the statistics that Senator Tobin is referencing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe my question is, have you talked to law officers? Do you have letters of support? Have you heard input from them in your line of work? Have you talked with your fellow colleagues about their input on this particular stance on usurping state control of the ability to ensure that Alaskans stay safe or other states who have the right to establish their own state policy? Does your organization have an opinion on that?
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, that would be negative. I don't have any information on any of those questions.
Representative Rauscher.
Representative Rauscher, for the record, Senator Tobin, one of the key things about this bill is to gain a handgun concealed carry permit, you have to be fingerprinted, you have to have an FBI check, you have to have gone through a program, and you have to pass it, have a piece of paper saying you've done so. Now, in the other states, which we're talking about, which I had previously mentioned, you would also have to do this. So what this paper says is you have all that. Your fingerprints are on record. You have an FBI check. You've been through all of those in the state of Alaska or whichever state you're from. And so those states which actually allow the same thing to happen, you don't have to retest in each one of those states. That's basically what we're doing. It's like having a driver's license and not having to take the test as you drive from one state to another. So we're saying of the states that allow this, you would be able to show your license that you have already gone through the program, which will also signify that you have been fingerprinted, you have had an FBI check, and you're probably one of the lowest population that would actually have an offense. Statistically, and 8.4% of U.S. adult population right now has a concealed carry permit. That's a lot of people right now. So I could say this is not a bill for some, it's not a bill for all, but it is a bill for a large number of people.
Follow up?
Senator Tobin.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that clarity. I do know some of those other states that have concealed carry permits, also have restrictions on domestic violence for stalkers, for felons, and I didn't hear you mention any of those particular stipulations. So within your estimation, would this usurp a state's ability to provide those additional provisions to ensure that their community members stay safe?
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Senator Tobin. This came up earlier, and that's a good question. So you still have to abide by whatever laws that current state has. It doesn't supersede like Alaska, which is fairly limited on what you need to do. We couldn't just go to, say, California and bypass all the restrictions they have. Once you enter that state, you have to abide by any requirements that state has. You too have to follow. What this resolution is encouraging is reciprocity, saying that they cannot just simply say, we don't allow you to carry here because you're not a resident of the state, but you do still have to follow all those rules.
Brief follow-up?
Senator Tobin.
How would you enforce that? How would a law officer enforce that? You say that it's because someone would have to follow those rules. How do we ensure that that person is following those rules?
Representative Rauscher, Senator Sogan, it's the same way a law officer would do to a member of his own state. There's no way to know until a criminal act has been done. And then you would obviously have a case, okay, for what you're talking about. So I'm just going to give you some examples off the wall, that hypotheticals that don't really say, like there was a state in, say, New Jersey, and they had a handgun concealed carry program, but they didn't allow you to carry one anywhere near a shopping store or anywhere near a theater or whatever. And so you basically have to follow those same laws in New Jersey. Now you're in a different state. Let's say it's Colorado, and you're allowed to go to the theater with a concealed weapon on you. Then you would be allowed to do that in Colorado. But you can't say, well, Alaska lets us do this, 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 and this. I am now in Colorado, and now I have the right to do all of that. You have to follow those rules there. And the only way they can check whether you are is the same way they would be able to check somebody in their own state, if I'm answering your question correctly, is to have somebody who has done something wrong, and now they have committed the offense. And I believe that's the only way they could even do it in their own state.
Let me ask you a question before I go back to Senator Tobin. Let's say here in Alaska, somebody's got a concealed carry permit, and they go down to, let's say, New Mexico. And in New Mexico, the way they issue concealed carry permits, they say that if you have a domestic violence restraining order, you can't have a concealed carry permit. And let's assume that, I actually don't know the requirements here in Alaska, but let's assume we in Alaska don't have that requirement. So a person with a DV restraining order in Alaska could get the concealed carry permit. Now they show up in New Mexico. Is New Mexico supposed to accept that concealed carry permit from Alaska, even though New Mexico would say you couldn't qualify for one in New Mexico?
My understanding is no.
Okay. Senator Tobin. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Up to the chair. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I maybe just to follow up on a couple of Senator Tobin's questions. I was looking through the U.S. House Resolution 38 that this state resolution endorses, and I was a little less than clear on some of the provisions and how they relate to some of Senator Tobin's questions. So one of the things that I read there is that a person who is entitled to carry a concealed firearm in the state in which the person resides. And it specifically said that's an or. So either has a concealed carry permit at home or is entitled to carry at home. This says they can carry in any state that doesn't prohibit concealed carry. So Alaska, if I remember correctly, doesn't require a permit to carry concealed. Do I understand this U.S. House bill to say an Alaskan doesn't need any kind of permit at all to carry in, say, New Jersey, which requires one?
The chair, Representative Rauscher, can you restate your question one more time so I get a better understanding before I answer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The federal legislation allows a person who either has a permit to carry in their home state or is entitled to carry a concealed firearm in their home state to carry in any state that does not prohibit concealed carry. So my understanding of the text would be that an Alaskan doesn't need a permit, if this passes, to carry in New Jersey that requires one.
The chair, Representative Rauscher, I would agree with your last statement and what you have said.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up.
Senator Keel.
So then the discussion we had earlier about a background check and fingerprinting not applicable in those cases. Is that correct?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Senator Keel. My understanding is in the state of Alaska, we're going to use the state of Alaska for this instance, which I think is an example of what you're saying. I do not believe that anybody would stop somebody from concealed carrying in Alaska since it's illegal to do so. Is that your question?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Keel.
The question really goes to another state that only allows concealed carry by permit.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I read this federal legislation, if enacted, it would allow an Alaskan who doesn't have an Alaska permit to carry in that other state that does require a permit. And thus, the Alaskan would not have to have had a background check, would not have to have been fingerprinted. They could carry in that other state without permit, without background check, without fingerprinting.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I do not believe that's true.
Senator Keel, follow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I wasn't sure whether you were finished or whether you had more questions.
Yeah, so this would be maybe a good question for Legislative Legal Services just on the text of the federal law, because that's my sort of plain language reading of it. Happy to move on to another subtopic, if I may.
And there's a request to see if we can get Leg Legal on the line. We're trying to get them on the line. They're not here yet, but go ahead to the next question.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, there was discussion earlier about limitations on where a person may carry concealed. And there I thought that the federal legislation was a little ambiguous, and that its drafters may have as well, because they put a provision in that says that U.S. House Resolution 38 can't be construed to supersede or limit laws of a state. And then it's two, that let a private person or entity prohibit a concealed firearm on their property, or that prohibit carrying concealed on state or local government property. And there's a little list, parks and buildings and bases. It doesn't say anything about, for instance, Alaska's restriction on concealed carry in bars or churches or daycares. So do I understand the federal legislation correctly that if enacted, it would let someone from, say, Texas, where you can carry in church, come to Alaska and carry in church here where it's illegal?
Representative Rauscher, for the record, to the chair, Senator Keel, no. You have to abide by the laws of each state. And my understanding, when you looked into the legislation, I hope that's what they call that at the federal level, H.R. 38, they didn't try to rewrite states' rights in their understanding of this. And the idea is to allow states to have their rights, to keep their rights. And so here, you can't have it in a bar, just because you can in Texas, to understand the situation you have brought forth. Someone from Texas who can have a gun in a bar will not be able to have a gun in the state of Alaska if that is the law in the state of Alaska, that you cannot carry a gun in a bar. I believe that's a law, but I'm not a police officer. I can't tell you.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up.
Senator Keel.
So I'm looking at what is it, page 3, line 19 through page 4, line 3 of the federal H.R. 38 in the packet. The only carve-outs are the ones I described. Can you help me understand why those are the only carve-outs?
I do not, through the chair, I do not have this. Okay, here it is. What page? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, page 3, starting at line 19 and then ending at page 4, line 3.
Yes.
So the question would be, why are those two the only carve-outs if, in fact, we're able to carve out for churches and daycares and bars?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Senator Keel, I do not know.
Those are questions we can certainly. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess just a comment. I guess the rationale the logic that we would be looking for would be similar to licensing a driver. And I'm not sure if this is reflected. It'll be interesting to see the answer to all these questions. But I think the rational purpose of this it would be that you get your driver's license in Alaska, but when you're in another state, the maximum speed limit is higher or lower. It's different. You can do turns on right, or you can't do turns at red on right. So just where those variances, you're under the local rules, such as they are, but the fact that you have a license is, so when I heard the earlier reference to, it sounded like to how we treat driver's licenses and the respect that they get elsewhere, although you still have the caveat that you have to obey the local rules. And it'll be interesting to see if that logic stands up when we get with Ledge Legal.
Senator Tobin, I know we all got ahead of you here.
Oh, no, that's okay. And thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to respond, I've been thinking a lot about this conflagration between driver's license and concealed carry permits. My nephew just turned 18 in New York. Prior to 18, he wasn't allowed to drive with a young person under the age of 18 in his vehicle. He wasn't allowed to drive after 6 p.m. at night alone. There were rules placed in New York that are more restrictive than the rules in Alaska. And so when I think about this compact of a driver's license, we still allow states to create safe mechanisms for what is right for their communities. And I think that's where we're really trying to get to with the state having the authority to establish what we believe is the right way to carry a firearm and not having other states or the federal government tell us what is right for Alaska. I do have a question. Here in the state of Alaska, you cannot conceal and carry under the age of 21. And so within this and the way that I'm reading it, again, on page 3, Mr. Chairman, that provision would not be respected underneath this federal resolution, or I'm not actually sure. Again, federal bill. I'm not sure what we call this. And so that's my question to you. Here in the state of Alaska, we've established this as state law. However, it would seem that that wouldn't be honored within this. Is that your interpretation?
Representative Rauscher, for the record, through the chair, Senator Tobin, that's not my interpretation. My interpretation is if you can't drive at the age of 14 in the state of New York City, and you can in Missouri because you have a farm license, I don't believe that that will work in the state of New York. As an example, not to say either of those have that law, but I know there are some states when I was growing up that allowed you to have a farmer's license at the age of 14, and you were able to just do certain farm work. And if you were outside of that parameter, then you were running afoul of the law. And so I would have to say that's not going to work in the state of New York City if they don't have a 14-year farm license law.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not the interpretation I have. Again, I'm not a lawyer, and so it would be helpful if we did have some backup by a lawyer.
Well, we requested Ledge Legal. They were unable to call in today. I clearly have questions, and we can work with getting answers to those questions before we hear the bill again. Okay. One more question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hopefully, you even have
a follow-up.
Thank you. Much easier question, I think. In the federal bill, it says you got to have for those with a concealed carry permit, you need the permit and an ID. It defines ID, and it doesn't appear to include tribal identification. Tribal ID is good enough to fly. It's good enough to show at the DMV. Are you aware, does this definition of an identification document include tribal IDs? What could we find out?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, to Representative Keel. I apologize. I've been playing in the House for a long time, and I just have to apologize. At least I keep correcting myself. I still would like you to restate what you had just said one more time before answering.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I guess it's a research question. The definition in the federal legislation that's endorsed here it defines identification document, and it's not clear to me whether that would include a tribal identification. And many Alaska tribes issue IDs. So if we could just get back on that when the bill comes back.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair to Senator Keel, my understanding is that if you are required to have a driver's license in the state of Alaska to drive on a highway, and they want you to have a driver's license to drive on the state of a highway in another state which has a concealed license, you're going to have one in that state also, as well as you would have to have one here. I'm pretty sure when I worked in the villages that you had a separate license where you were able to not take as big a test, driver's license test, because of where you were. There weren't a lot of things. Now, that was in King Cove maybe 25 years ago, and the things may have changed by now. But I still have to pay. You have to pay all the laws that are there, and I don't think you get an off just because of wherever you're from, and you set a piece of paper for that. If that answers your question, I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, I can follow up offline. I think this definition includes a passport. It includes a state ID that's not a driver's license. Just curious whether it also includes a tribal ID. We can follow up later.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, Senator Keel, I don't know whether a passport works to get a rent a car. I would say whatever works to get rent a car in this particular instance would probably have to happen also.
So I have a very technical question, then we're going to go ahead and open up for public testimony. I note a copy of the bill from Congress is a 2021 legislation.
Yes.
If they're like us, the bill is now dead. Is there a current bill that it has a different number? And if you don't need to know that now, but if you could find that out before we hear the bill again, because it would seem to me that to the extent there is a bill in Congress that we're trying to urge them to take up.
Representative Rauscher, to the chair, we will get that for you.
I don't see any other questions from the committee, so we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill or House Joint Resolution 3? I don't see anyone in the room, and online it looks like we have at least one person, Mr. Tom Bouton. Mr. Bouton, if you are on the phone, please make sure you are not on a speakerphone. The sound is not as clear and often difficult to hear what you're saying. If you want to go ahead and proceed with your remarks, we limit public testimony to 2 minutes. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Bouton, Juno, and I urge you to move HDR 3 out of committee as soon as possible. I've had an Alaska permit for 30 years or so. One time my plane out of Juneau was delayed by weather, so by the time my plane landed in Boston at midnight, my connecting plane to my final destination, which was a constitutional carry state, had long ago left. I had a revolver in my checked baggage. The airline insisted I just take my baggage at midnight. I don't think there's time to tell you what I did, and it might shock you a little bit at what I did, but I'll just say I've never been arrested or anything. We need this constitutional carry nationwide. With respect to the discussion the committee has been having today, it might be pertinent to point out that driving a car or even riding a horse is not guaranteed by the Constitution. But, of course, we do have the right to keep and bear arms. Thanks for your time, and thanks for all the hard work you do for Alaskans.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions from the committee. I don't have anyone else online to provide public testimony, so we're going to close public testimony on HJR 3. And we're going to hold this bill for further review. I know that there's a number of questions, so at this point I'm not going to set a deadline for amendments at this point. I would note there's a couple of instances in the bill that will need updates. In any event, it still lists Kevin McCarthy as the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. And I think that the bill says there are 19 states that have already have reciprocity provisions in their statute, including Alaska. And I gather that number of states that allow reciprocity in their statute is now 20. So those are some things in the bill that would need further review, but I think we will hear this bill again when we've had a chance to get some of these questions answered by Legislative Legal Services. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair of the Committee. Thank you.
Our third and last order of business today is Senate Bill 134, Insurance Data Security Information Security System, sponsored by Senator Kaufman. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Senator Kaufman and his staff, Dominic Harnett. If you would please come forward, identify yourselves for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
Thank you, Chair Klayman and the committee. For the record, Senator James Kaufman, Senate District F, Anchorage. Senate Bill 134 is intended to address the increasing concern over data breaches within the insurance industry over the last several years. These companies maintain sensitive personal, financial, and health information of millions of consumers. It is important to establish guidelines and standards to reduce the potential damage of data breaches within the industry. Senate Bill 134 would require state licensed insurance companies to perform a risk assessment of their internal and external threats, then develop, implement, and maintain an information security program based upon those threats. The standards of this bill are not wide in scope, but they do set the standards for governance, risk assessment, risk management, third-party risk management, and incidents response. Excuse me. SB 134 also lays out specific requirements for incident investigation and notification. The bill also empowers the Division of Insurance with the tools necessary to effectively oversee the protection of Alaskans' sensitive personal information by licensees. Similar legislation already exists in at least 23 other states, and the federal government has urged states to adopt similar measures, reflecting a nationwide recognition of the importance of these provisions. SB 134 is a proactive approach to protecting Alaska citizens' personal information from cyber threats and will enhance consumer protections and bolster the cybersecurity position of the insurance industry. So I thank the committee and the chair for your consideration. If you like, my assistant, Dominic Harnett, will go to the sectional and give the meat and potatoes of what changes.
Mr. Harnett, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dominic Harnett, staff to Senator Kaufman. Section 1 amends AS 2196 by adding a new section related to insurance data security. Licensees shall conduct a risk assessment of non-public information. In conducting the risk assessment, the licensee shall identify reasonably foreseeable internal and external threats, assess the likelihood and potential damage of threats, and assess the sufficiency of current safeguards in protecting non-public information. A licensee shall use this risk assessment to design the information security program required in the next section. The next section, section 2196-260, regarding the information security program. Licensees shall develop, implement, and maintain an information security program. The program is to be based off the threats identified in the previous section. Licensees shall designate one or more employees, an outside vendor, or third-party service provider to be responsible for their security program. A licensee's information security program must also contain safeguards to protect security and confidentiality of non-public information and the information system, protect against threats, hazards, and unauthorized access to non-public information, establish a schedule for retention of non-public information, and establish a mechanism for secure destruction of non-public information. The development and upkeep process of the licensee's information security program shall implement appropriate security measures such as information access controls, identification, and management of data access points, physical access controls, encryption, secure development practices, regular tests, audit trails, disaster responses, and secure disposal. Determine cybersecurity risks to include in the licensee's risk management process. They have to stay informed of emerging threats or vulnerabilities. They have to include cybersecurity risks in the licensee's enterprise-wide risk management process, provide personnel with cybersecurity awareness training, implement information safeguards addressing identified threats, and annually assess effectiveness of safeguards, exercise due diligence in their third-party service provider selection process, monitor, evaluate, and adjust the information security program as appropriate, establish a written incident response plan for responding to a cybersecurity event that addresses internal response processes, goals of the plan, roles, responsibilities, and decision authority, internal processes for communication and information sharing, and plans for how to remediate identified weaknesses, documentation and reporting of cybersecurity events, evaluation and revision process of incident response plan. Subsection D of this section requires the licensee board to delegate responsibility of the program to executive management, which is required to at least once a year develop a report that provides overall status of the information security program in compliance with the contents of this bill and material matters related to the information security program, such as assessments, decisions, test results, cybersecurity events, and more. If the executive management uses a delegate to implement the program, the executive management is required to oversee the development of the program by the delegate. In AS 2196-260F sets requirements for licensees domiciled in the state to submit annual reports to the Director of Insurance, certifying that the licensee complies with the earlier section, including keeping records for at least 5 years. Another section, 2196-270, is added, investigation of a cybersecurity event. This sets investigating requirements for licensees when a cybersecurity event occurs. If a cybersecurity event occurs, the licensee or responsible party shall investigate the event and assess the nature and scope of the event, identify non-public information involved, restore the security of the information systems that were compromised, and retain relevant information for a period of at least 5 years. Another section, 2196-280, this is notification of the cybersecurity event. This sets notification criteria for licensees when a cybersecurity event occurs. Licensees must notify the Director of Insurance within 72 hours of a cybersecurity event occurring. If they are insurers domiciled in the state, they are insurance producers in which Alaska is their home state. The cybersecurity event involves non-public information of 250 or more consumers, or the state or federal law requires notice to a government agency, or there is a reasonable likelihood of materially harming a consumer in the state or the licensee's normal operations. Their report to the Director of Insurance must include information specified in AS 2196-280B, this is the earlier section that I'm talking about here, in a form and format as prescribed by the director. Subsection E of this section allows the 72-hour notification period to begin 1 day after the licensee is made aware of a cybersecurity event affecting information systems maintained by a third-party service provider. And then subsection F of this section sets requirements for assuming insurers to notify effective ceding insurers and the appropriate supervisory officials of the licensee's state of domicile. Section 2196-290 regarding confidentiality. This establishes that all information shared with the division by licensees remains strictly confidential. This means that the information is not subject to inspection and copying under Alaska Statute 4025-110, is not obtainable by subpoena or discovery, and is not admissible in evidence in private civil action. Subsections B, C, D, and E of this section gives privileges to the director when using documents, materials, or information as described earlier in this section when done in the performance of the duties of the director. Section 2196-300 regarding applicability. This section establishes the criteria for which licensees are not subject to the provisions set by this bill, including licensees with fewer than 10 employees, licensees that are employees, agents, representatives, or designees of another licensee that is already covered by an information security program, and licensees is subject to and in compliance with HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996. Section 2196-310, Enforcement and Penalties, adds additional powers of examination and investigation to the director under Alaska Statute 2106-120. This does not create or imply a private cause of action if a licensee is found in violation of the stipulations within this bill. And then Section 2196-399 adds some definitions, some that I'll note, cybersecurity event. means an event resulting in unauthorized access to or disruption or misuse of an information system or information stored on the information system. An information security program is defined by means the administrative, technical, and physical safeguards that a licensee uses to access, collect, distribute, process, protect, store, use, transmit, dispose of, or otherwise handle non-public information. And a licensee means a person licensed, authorized to operate or registered, or required to be licensed, authorized, or registered under the insurance laws of the state of Alaska. Section 2 of our bill, it amends rules 26, 402, and 501 in the Alaska Rules of Evidence. Rule 26 prohibits discovery of evidence in the possession or control of the Division of Insurance that was provided by a licensee under earlier sections of this bill, or that is obtained by the director in an investigation or an examination under Alaska Statute 2196.310. Rule 402 and 501, Alaska Statute 2196.290A4NC, enacted in Section 1 of this bill, prevent the director of the Division of Insurance, acting under the authority of the director, from being compelled to testify about confidential or privileged documents. It also precludes admissibility of evidence in a private action of documents, materials, or other privileged information. Section 3, this section notices the division to begin the process of writing regulations but does not implement before the effective date. Section 4 is the confidential, regarding the confidentiality section, a conditional effect for it, enacted by Section 1 of this bill, requires a two-thirds majority vote of each house as required for court rule changes under Article 4, Section 15 of the Constitution of the State of Alaska. Section 5 sets an immediate date effective for Section 3 that the Division of Insurance can start drafting, so that the Division of Insurance can start drafting regulations. Section 6 sets an effective date for several provisions of this bill of January 1st, 2025, to give insurance companies and producers time to comply. Sets an effective date, Section 7 sets an effective date of January 1st, 2026, to give insurance companies and time to find a third-party service provider. And then Section 8, except as provided in earlier sections, the Act will set an effective date for the Act to allow time for compliance. Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, thanks for bringing the bill forward. I'm a fan of privacy protections. It's too bad we don't have an insurance director who could look at all the everything else and set standards for every place else companies have our personal information, but this is a start. In the neighborhood of just trying to understand the scope, the way I read the definitions section of the bill, this seems to be focused exclusively on cybersecurity, on computerized information. Does anything in the bill, or is there already something on the books, deal with insurance companies holding our personally identifiable information, our HIPAA protected information on paper? Is that already somewhere? Is that in your bill somewhere?
Through the chair to Senator Keel. Since you're asking a broader question about data protection writ large, paper or electronic, we do have Director Winghire here. And as you mentioned, we're quite a resource for these sort of things. So I will defer to Director Winghire if she would like to come up and discuss some of those broader issues. But before we do, I want to thank Dominic Harnett for grinding through that section. at the end of it, I want to say, but other than that, it doesn't do much. So just with that brief interlude. So, yes, if we could, I would like to.
Ms. Winghire. And I'd also note, as she comes forward, that Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the court system, is also available for questions.
Good evening. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
It's not evening.
My name is Lori Winghire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Through the chair to Senator Keel's question, we do have some very limited authority in Title 21 when there is a break-in of data. It does not extend to cyber, and frankly, almost every agency right now is paper-free, and the data would be a cyber risk as opposed to a material paper, pen and paper risk. But we do have some very limited authority. They absolutely have to tell us when there's been a breach, and we work with them then as far as notifying clients to, be it they get free credit reporting or whatever happens in that individual situation, sir.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The director anticipated my next question, which is that the bill talks a lot about notifying you when there's been a cybersecurity event, a breach of some kind, but it doesn't speak directly to notifying the consumer. There's a reference to the Alaska Personal Information Protection Act. I don't know if that requires consumer notification. Is there something in your existing statutes or regs elsewhere? How is that handled?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, again, we have very limited, but we would most definitely have them notify the consumers, if you will, if their data was compromised. Just to give you a kind of a story, you may or may not have read recently in the headlines about the Change Healthcare data breach. They are a platform owned by United Healthcare. It has brought this nation pharmacies, hospitals, and medical clinics to their knees. The breach was in February. Change Healthcare has various platforms for pre-authorization of your medical or your prescriptions to pick up your meds. And we have very little authority to work with them because we don't have a cyber bill. I just got back from NEIC last night, and we had the CEO at the NEIC.
What's NEIC?
I'm sorry, sir. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners. We had our spring meeting in Phoenix, and we had the CEO in on a regulator-to-regulator session on Sunday. And I can tell you we grilled him because this is such a huge event. There's clinics and facilities that might have to close because they can't make payroll because they're not getting paid. They don't just process United Healthcare claims. They process many insurance companies and many doctors and many pharmacists' claims. We issued a bulletin to try and help consumers, but it was about as far as I could go.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to make sure on consumer notifications of breaches, you're comfortable that the 4548 language here and your other statutes give you the authority to notify or to require an insurer to notify the customers whose data has been breached?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that is what we would use, is the authority in what is already in Alaska statute to make sure consumers were notified of the breach of their data.
Thank you.
Probably nothing if we wanted to add something to the statute that did require consumer notification, we could do that. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for the bill sponsor and then one for Ms. Wing-Hire. There is some very involved definitions. I'm reading through them, and I would be hard-pressed to come up with a definition for all of these things that is as eloquently written as here is in the legislation. So I'm curious if this is model legislation that comes from another entity, or if your incredible staff spent all the time creating the definition for multi-factor authentication, or for authorized individual, or for all the ones that are in the definition section, as they are quite thorough.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, God bless my staff, and they are marvelous, but no, this is a collaborative effort. And there's a great deal of, I'd say earlier, it does reference, other models influenced by them. And there's also a great deal of input that has been going on. We have a matrix, as you might expect, of trying to work the problem, what the solution and how to mitigate any of the effects of it. So this has been quite the piece of work, and my staff has been in the middle of it all. But then again, we have resources such as Director Wing-Hire and industry folks that are weighing in. I'd say it's a work in progress. I expect there will be more input and more clarifications about the implementation of this. But what is remarkable, I think, is as you read through the list of things that it does, that we're not doing this already. And so the simple desire that we protect our data
as just the simple problem. There is complexity in making sure that we don't hinder or create increased costs or create bottlenecks, create conflicts that can't be reconciled. So a great deal of work has gone on in collaboration with many to try and get to that point.
Second question.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
We'll
Chairman.
Give you three if you want.
Thank you. And so that brings me to my next question around consumer protections. And this might be a better technical question for Director Wing-Hire. I know one of the strongest levels of consumer protection is double-end encryption. However, I am unsure if that is possible within the insurance world because you would need to decouple identifying information and provide that end-to-end ability. Within this purview, how is there a way or is there any potential way to decouple identifying information so that we can provide an extra level of consumer protection, or is that just too great a hill to climb?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, when it comes to claim information, specific claim information, that is double encrypted. I mean, it's something that we've been working on with our health payment utilization databases. The data is transmitted. But underwriting information is not necessarily double encrypted. So you could, if you had a data security, you could come into a specific file, yours or Senator Clayman's, maybe not get the claims, but you get your Social Security number, your date of birth, and anything else that they have collected on you during the underwriting process. And keep in mind, this isn't just for life insurance or health insurance. This is for all insurance.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am unsure if that's a possibility within this particular construct and looking at some of the definitions, particularly on page 13, line 19, where it says encrypt, if there is additional provisions we might be able to do to help tighten some of those things or maybe provide some strength. I'm just particularly thinking about my family members in which we have many insurance tools to protect us. However, I want to ensure that also our data is protected. And if there's abilities to provide some clarity on what we can double encrypt and what we may not be able to double encrypt, or any of those additional protections that we could put within this, the expectation being thereof to decouple as much information as possible.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I can spend some time with Senator Kaufman in his office to see. I will tell you, though, that my guess is that insurers will tell you that they'd have to change their platforms, their programs, but we can certainly look into it to see that what we can come back and tell you that if there's additional restraints that we could put in the bill to protect information.
Senator Coburn, my staff advised that your office already is interested in some significant changes in FRISS. Yes, from a timeline standpoint, what's a likely timeline that you all would be able to come up with some of this CS that you've been talking about? I assume tomorrow, not by tomorrow, but
I would say through the chair. Probably early next week. We've been working it, as we say down south, working the hair off of it. So I think we're pretty far along, and perhaps with a few other inquiries that we look into as a result of this hearing, we'll be in good shape.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think two more from topics for me. One, a technical question. I see deadlines for insurers to notify the director where there's a breach in a system that's maintained by a third party, somebody the insurer has on contract. We don't start those deadlines until the third party tells the insurer. Do we have a timeline for that?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, the timelines and the notifications are part of what we've been working on. Director Wing-Hire may want to address some details now, but that chain of notification and how to manage it and the accountabilities for that has been part of what we've been working.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Keel, industry has come to Senator Kaufman and asked to have 3 days instead of 72 hours. And in negotiating back and forth, to me, that was okay, as long as the first day was the day they were notified. As respects third-party vendors, that's an issue. Because generally, I don't have authority over regulatory or statutory authority over third-party vendors. I do over the insurance company. So we're trying to pass it down to them that they are liable or responsible for the acts, and hopefully their contracts are strong to say that we are going to look to the insurance company not necessarily the vendor, again, because I don't have any authority over them. But it is, I mean, we deal with it all the time. It was the discussions this weekend of how do I get to a third-party vendor. And with the algorithms and the models that they are using now, it's a concern. But again, I just don't have the authority. All I can tell you is that the insurer has to tell me within 3 days of when their vendor tells them, and hopefully the contract has immediate notification.
Senator, in follow-up on that, I'd be interested in working with the sponsor's office and the director on something to require those insurance companies have provisions in their contracts, give you the power to do that, so that we don't end up in a situation where someone just doesn't end up hearing about it, and then you never get the opportunity to spark your response plan. On another topic in the
bill, Senator Keel.
The director used the word liable. always trigger. the confidentiality provisions in the bill, it is not clear to me how far they go. It seems to me that they prohibit production of my personally identifiable information in a suit against a company, but it's not clear to me whether they prohibit effectively any information from the division come into court if someone sues the company for instance, breaking your rules that you've set about cybersecurity. Can you help us with how deep this goes?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I would say it's pretty clear that the division has to keep any market conduct or examination or investigation that we would be doing confidential. That doesn't stop you as a concerned citizen from getting it from the insurance company directly through a court action, but so that the investigation is not impeded, our files would be confidential. And that's true on about any investigation that the division does. Our files are confidential. Doesn't stop you from getting them from the parties that were responsible for the data breach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the necessity then for a court rule change, if this is comparable to all the existing process and practice?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, that is exactly why it's a courtroom change, a court rules change, because of the fact that in a normal procedure, perhaps you could get it from the division as having possession of the data, but this is saying no, you cannot get it from the division. You have to go to the party, the insurance company, or whom the adjuster, the brokerage firm, whoever had your data and was responsible for the breach.
So, Mr. Chairman, then it sounds like then this provision would differ from our standard practice. Then.
I'm sorry if I spoke. Yes, I mean it is. That's why we have the court rule. Why it takes it but a two-thirds vote then to get recognition of the change.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go in a slightly different direction. In reading the bill language, I see that small brokerage firms are exempt, those with, I think it's fewer than 10 employees, and I'm assuming because it's an unfair burden or an undue burden that could be potentially put on the smaller firms. And so my question is around on some of the brokerage firms that might use a franchise model. I'm not entirely sure of how to describe that, but when I think of my insurance provider who is under the auspice of New York Life, but may not necessarily have other employees other than one or two in their office, or they've kind of franchised that out, would they be required to meet the stipulations of this legislation, or would they be exempt?
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, we would expect, let's say, in your example of a franchise, a Marsh McLennan, a State Farm, in Allstate, we would expect them to comply. If it were a small independent who had 10 employees or less, then they would have a waiver under this bill from complying.
Thank you. That's helpful to understand. And then my second question is really on the court rule change as stipulating the law. I'd love to hear from Ms. Mead just further understand as I know it often comes up around when the legislature steps their toes into court rule changes.
I was going to call up Ms. Meek because I had a question for her, but why don't you finish any questions you might have for Ms. Wing-Hire first, and then we'll make them switch seats.
I think my questions for Ms. Wing-Hire have exceeded what I have in my form. I am sure if I come up with any additional ones, I'll work with the bill sponsor.
Ms. Mead, please come forward. If all goes well, Senator Tobin will ask my questions too.
For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I welcome your questions.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, as I read here on page 15, the indirect court rule amendments and the language is essentially establishing a change in court rules and creating new privileges for the Division of Insurance. And just curious to hear your interpretation and potentially any of your insight or input on these particular shifts, as I know that court rule changes should be met judiciously.
Thank you, through the chair, to Senator Tobin. These are what I would consider to be fairly routine court rule changes that the legislature makes because it must when it's establishing something in statute that is part and parcel of the substantive legislation. And because on page 10, starting at line 22, there are very specific and unique provisions regarding confidentiality. It says this information would be privileged, not subject to discovery. And that one is directly linked to, flipping back to page 15, the first indirect court rule amendment. Rule 26, there mentioned on line 15 of page 15, is the discovery rule, which very, very generally says a party in a civil case can ask for and get from the other party everything relevant, unless there's an exception, that would help them prepare for the case. So since your statute on page 10 says this information may not be obtained in discovery, that would be a new exception. So our Rule 26 would be thereby affected. So that is, as I say, a fairly routine indirect court rule amendment. The other one that they mention is similar. Changing rules 402 and 501 of our rules of evidence, mentioned on line 21 of page 15, is those are the rules about what privileges exist. It will list the spousal privilege and psychotherapist patient privilege, etc. And this is a special privilege established in law that our evidence rules would need to recognize. And that would be the basis for those indirect court rule changes.
Okay. You answered my question as well. I don't see any other questions. I'll make a observation to the bill sponsor. One of the challenges that we have in this highly accessible internet area, particularly like insurance, If I want to know what insurance coverage do I have, I want to find it really easily. So as the consumer that's buying insurance, I don't want to have to go through 15 layers and not really know where to find it. I want to quickly be able to go find it, find that information, whether it's medical records or what's my car coverage. And by the same token, the companies that provide insurance, I actually want to make that accessible to me, the consumer. And then the flip side of that is everybody but me, the consumer, I don't want anybody to be able to find it no matter how hard they try. And trying to do those things at the same time is actually quite challenging. And I really appreciate this legislation because it's dealing in that very complicated dynamic between we all want to get online and see all the stuff that we want, and we don't want to let anybody else see it except the ones we absolutely think are necessary.
And a comment to that, please?
Yes, absolutely. Didn't require, but absolutely have.
Thank you to the chair. That's been the great balance in this. There's, you know, you're affecting a lot of pieces and parts, and there's sensitivity around implementation and then also avoiding loopholes while, you know, trying to basically affect these changes, which are they're typical of what we find ourselves where we're updating ourselves in a technological world that has rushed past where statutes and our ability to keep up with things. in a different piece of legislation we were just talking about, how the absence of anything about drones in that piece of legislation, it leaves a big gap that needs to be updated in statute. So there's these areas are not easy. That's why they languish. And the front of technology moves on, and it's difficult to take in everything a snapshot at the time, connect all the parts, come up with all the pieces that will work, but also will still enable commerce to occur. Like you said, you want your data, you want to be able to get to it, you like to have a portal, but that portal has to be accessible, controlled, and has to have the front end and back end protections. That means you can get to the data, but it's not everyone that can get to it.
I'd like to open public testimony on Senate Bill 134. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill 134? Don't see anyone. I'm looking online, and I do not have anyone online, so I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 134. At this time, we are going to hold this bill for further review. We're going to adjourn for the day. If any member, actually, we're not going to announce that deadline because we're going to have follow-up from Leg Legal on House Joint Resolution 3. Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, March 22nd at 1:30 p.m. And with that, we were graveled out. The time is 2:46.